So Rabbi Rapp is a graduate of Columbia Law School. He currently serves as Associate Dean of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University. At Yeshiva University, he's a Yadin Musmach. And he also sits frequently, I would say, as a dayan at the Beth Din of America. And it's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Rapp.
I'd like to start by apologizing. Never a good way to start. I actually have to run out right afterwards. I have a paying job that I have to attend to. So I will not be here to take questions afterwards. If anyone has questions, I'm sure the other panelists will do a fine job at answering it. If you think it's absolutely necessary that I answer it, please feel free to yell out in the middle. People generally don't need to be encouraged to do this. I've learned. When we discuss the major question of why to go to Beis Din, there are many answers that are offered. There is the plus of the speed of the Beis Din, the fact that the Beis Din process is much quicker than going to courts. There is the cost savings, partially because of the speed savings, the time savings, etc. These are all good reasons to go to Beis Din, but the major reason why people should go to Beis Din is the same reason that we eat kosher and the same reason that we keep Shabbos, and we do all the other mitzvahs HaTorah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says so. Like, we don't wear Shabbos, and like, we don't eat Chazer. We also don't go to secular courts. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. The Pasuk says at the very beginning of Pasuk Mishpatim, Eil HaMishpat Asher Tosin Lefneihem, and Rashi, right there and then, quotes the Gemara in Gittin, Lefneihem V'lo Lefnei Akum. That just like a person is required to do all the other mitzvahs, if a person has a dispute, a person has to take that dispute to Beis Din. It's not a typical Isser, because in many ways it ends up being much stronger. If you look at the Rashi, if you look at the Rambam, they compare a person who violates the rule of Arkos, a person who violates the rule and goes to a non-Jewish forum for dispute resolution, as if the person was Oved Avodah Zarah, as if they were part of idol worship. Which is a very strong statement. Everyone has their Averas that they do. None of us are perfect. What about this Avera? What about this requirement makes it so significant that it's on the level of idol worship, one of the three cardinal sins? And the truth of the matter is, if you sit back and you think about it, it really makes sense. Basically, we have a few basic beliefs, our 13 principles of faith. One of our 13 principles is we have an understanding that God is perfect. One. Two, we believe that the Torah is the Word of God. And therefore, the Torah is perfect. In the event that a person makes a statement that I would like to use a different form of law, a different form of dispute resolution, I am making one of two statements. Either I believe that God is not perfect because there's something better than his idea, or I'm making a statement that I don't believe that the Torah comes from God. Either one of those are pretty bad statements. So therefore, the statement that is made by the violation of the halacha of Arkos is a very significant violation. That's why the Rambam and Rashi say it's on the level of Avodah Zarah. Because I'm either making a statement that I don't think God is perfect, or I'm making a statement that I don't think this is God's word. So that is why the very basic reason why we have to go to Beis Din if we find ourselves in a situation where we have a dispute that needs to be resolved is because the Torah says so, and the Torah is quite serious about this. This isn't the Chumra Ba'alma. Right? This is a real Avera, and one that carries very significant consequences if a person violates it. That being said, I think it's only fair that we discuss a little bit, how could this be so? So I've made a statement which seems to make logical sense. Were it not to, I'm sure we have someone yelled out by now, which basically are two very basic beliefs that we have in Judaism. One, the perfection of God. Two, the divinity of the Torah. That being said, if a person takes a step back and considers the laws of the Torah, one would have to at least raise an eyebrow to see how this is perfection. Let's just go through some of the laws. Murder. In the event that I decided that that guy over there is playing with his cell phone now and therefore has to be shot, I pull out my gun and I take care of it. What's my punishment according to the Torah? What? I was not warned, therefore I walk away from it. Listen, and the next guy won't play with his phone. That's another thing I point out. Just note for the record. So, right, as long as there was no hasra, that's, someone went over to me and said, by the way, do you realize if you shoot him, you'll be liable for the death penalty? I'm constantly. In fact, according to the Rambam, even if someone did say that, and I smiled and I shot anyhow, I'd still be putter because I was not matir atzal misa. I didn't get up and I didn't say, I understand, and but despite that, I'm going to shoot him anyhow. So therefore, there's a major question, is how would one run a society based on laws like this? The punishment for stealing. Anybody? I'm a bank robber. Kefel, if... No, right. That depends how I do it. Also, if you come over to me and say, by the way, did you rob the bank? And I say, yeah, I robbed the bank.
What's
what? No, that's motive b'knas and potter. Right? So therefore, again, we at Sly Sims are starting a new major, the pre-bank robbery major. You rob 5 banks a day, you get caught 4 times, you make a nice parnasa. Right? That would be the approach that we could take. Right? Rape? Tosser. It is usser. Yes, it is. This is being recorded. It is absolutely usser. 50 shekel. All right.
Yes, certain one.
What?
Only certain one.
What? 50 shekel. You sit back and you think about it. The question is, how do you ever... Here I am talking to, I get up and I make a statement that this is the perfect legal system, and therefore anyone who would deny anything of the perfection, I'm calling a kofer. On the other hand, I'm not really sure how anyone is ever supposed to run a society based on this Torah thing. So this was discussed already a long time ago. The first person to deal with it at length is the Drushus HaRan. The Drushus HaRan, which was probably written by the Ran. There's some discussion about it. Right? The name would be a giveaway. The Drushus HaRan talks about the idea that there was always were concurrent legal systems. That there was something called Mishpat HaTorah and Mishpat HaMelech. Now, according to the Mishpat HaTorah, in order that you convict somebody, they have to have, it needs to be Hasra, Motiv HaKnas, etc. However, there is the institution of Melech. A king is supposed to run society. And as such, running society means that he has to change the rules from time to time. If he realizes that there is an issue in something or another, he has to step up there and step in. I realize that this person really did it. We can't have murderers running around, so the king puts him to death. Concurrent legal systems. The Abarbanel basically agrees with the Ran. The Abarbanel, however, thinks that it wasn't the Mishpat HaMelech, it was rather the Beis Din themselves. Beis Din Makir V'Onshin Shalom Min Adin. That the Beis Din has extra legal powers. They were the ones who would actually take care of the people that needed to be taken care of. This was all a very interesting discussion until 1947. 1947, which happens to be the year before 1948. Funny how that worked out. There was a discussion. The state of Israel was about to be established. And there was an understanding of the Zionist rabbis of the time that there were many things they wanted this new state to look like, and it wasn't going to look like everything they wanted. So Rav Herzog, who was going to be the first Rabbi Rashi, sent out a series of letters to various other rabbanim of the time, asking them, what do we fight on, and what do we give in on? So there were basically 4 categories that they were interested in. One was personal status. That when it comes to marriage or divorce, that should be religious. That's one. 2 is public Shmirah Shabbos. Not every individual in the state of Israel is going to keep Shabbos, but the country should, right? The government offices should close for Shabbos, right? The airport maybe the airline, right? Yes, there should be, at least on a public level, we should keep Shabbos. Similarly, on a public level, 3 was to keep kosher. That the Knesset should serve kosher, that the army should be kosher. That was 3. And 4 was this idea of introducing halacha as the new law of the state of Israel. Up until now, the state of Israel's, what were its laws? It had some British common law, it had some Turkish law. Over the years, whoever was in charge put on their layer. They said, why don't we just take out the entire thing, throw it in the garbage, and bring it in, we're Jewish now, let's do Jewish law. And there was an understanding that Ben-Gurion wasn't going to give in on 4. So where do we push and where do we not push? So we sent letters to Rav Nehriya, sent letters to Rav Goronchik. And he got a response from Rav Garunchik. People know Rav Garunchik? Rav Garin, that's right. Right. There's the chief rabbi formerly known as Garunchik. So Rav Garin stepped up, and he sends back a letter that let's forget about the halacha thing. He said, why? The Drushas Haran. You look at the Drushas Haran, what does the Drushas Haran said? The Drushas Haran says that ultimately the true law of the land is what? Mishpat HaMelech. That yes, for religious reasons we have these halachas that we talk about, Hasra, but in the practical day-to-day, what's going to matter is the Mishpat HaMelech. Now who's going to be the Melech? The Knesset. Knesset's going to be the Melech. So Manushach. Either way, it's going to come down to the Knesset's laws. So why would I use political capital to end up right where we'd end up anyway? That was Rav Gorin's response. And Rav Herzog sends back a very long and very strong response, which can be read in the Kisvei Rav Herzog. Well, he writes that you're not understanding anything. You don't get the Drushas Haran. Basically, the point that he's making is as follows. He says, we understand in halacha there are two general categories. There's chok and there's mishpat. Chok are things we don't understand, and mishpat are things we do understand. We don't understand why we wear tefillin. We don't understand parah aduma. We don't understand shanis. But we do understand why you can't kill people. And we do understand why you can't steal. He said, your approach is that everything is chok. I thought that it was mishpat, this whole idea of the laws of murder. You're saying, nah, that's a Torah thing, but really, Knesset. Right? I thought, no, you're throwing out all the mishpat, you're making everything into chok. But isn't that the point? So he makes the following point, and it's a very basic and very important point, and it's very important for us to understand. When it comes, what is the Torah trying to do? So the Torah has a set of laws. What the Torah does not do, and what the Torah cannot do, Rav Herzog posits, is it cannot make a deterrent. Deterrents have to change from society, from generation to generation. To give an example, we in New York, across the bridge, have something called the Rockefeller Laws, which people may be familiar with. Under the Rockefeller Laws, a person who is caught with illegal substances is oftentimes punished worse than someone who does murder. There are mandatory sentencing guidelines. If you get caught even with a minor amount, three times, you get 25 years to life. That which murderers don't get. And many people are very upset about the Rockefeller Laws, but they remain on the books. Why do they remain on the books if it's such a ridiculous law? Because it's not. The idea is that society has to make a decision. And a society may rightfully decide that illegal drugs are such a problem in this society, and it leads to the breakdown of families, and it leads to murder, and it leads to stealing, and it leads, and it leads, and it leads, that it is necessary for us to really come down hard on this in order that people will stop doing it, and that will save society. A different society doesn't have this problem, and therefore they have a right of law. When it comes to using the law as a disincentive for people violating the law, that is something that has to change as society changes. Right? There are different societies that have different problems, and therefore it is the job of the leaders of that society to make the decisions. So what does the Torah do? The Torah says this is a bare minimum. If a person kills with hasra, even if you tell me the person would never do it again and no one's going to learn from the person, etc., and they feel terrible about what they did, that's the bare minimum. They got to be put to death. But beyond that, depending on society, you might want to adjust the bar upwards to keep society running the way that it should. However, that's only talking about criminal law. In criminal law, you have this issue that you want to stop people from doing things. In civil law, by and large, you're not stopping anyone from doing anything. There's a contract between two parties. And now, something happens that the contract hadn't considered beforehand. Right? No one spelled out clearly, if two planes hit the two buildings, is that considered one occurrence or two occurrences? Now, what are we trying to stop at this point? Are we trying to stop people from buying insurance? There's nothing that we're trying to stop. We're not trying to stop people from selling insurance. No. Many cases, the majority of civil law, are places where nothing has to be stopped. There has to be disincentivized These are all situations where we just have to work out who's right. This person has a certain right, that person has a right. I have a right. I live in an apartment. I have a right to play drums. You're my neighbor. You have a right to sleep. We don't want to stop people from playing drums, and we don't want to stop people from sleeping. We just have to balance the rights. My right versus your right, which is the stronger right, we have to make a decision. This is what societies throughout the years have been trying to do through the development of civil law. Right? A classic case. If I find something in your backyard, I remember in law school discussing this at length. Right? So, under a British common law, when someone would be sitting and if they found something in someone else's backyard, what would the din be? Well, you had to look. Is this item lost or misplaced? That was the way they assumed. If it was lost, meaning the guy was walking and it fell out of his pocket, so he never intended on relying on the area. Therefore, whoever finds it keeps it. However, if it was misplaced, if I put something down, therefore I was relying on the area, and then someone else found it, so that it's the person whose area it was. Of course, the obvious problem is the only way I'm going to know if the person wanted to leave it there or not is if I ask the person. And if I knew the person to ask, I would just return it to him. No one would get to keep it. It was logically a great law that never made any sense. So, literally hundreds of years of English common law would discuss, well, if it's like this, if it's like that, if it's spread out, it probably fell out of his pocket. If it's piled neatly, it's a lot like the Gemara. It goes through the entirety of what could happen. What would Halacha say about a case? If I find a Metziah b'chotzer of someone else? What? Not. His is about anyone at this point. That's not very helpful. But leaving that aside, we don't look at the item, we look at the chotzer. Is it a chotzer meshumer or is it a chotzer she'eno meshumer? Right? If this is a place where people know, you don't have to look at the item, look at the larger area, etc. We believe that which society is trying to reach, the perfect set of laws, which they have been adapting to over the years, we have already. We already have the law given down by God. We believe that our law, at least in terms of civil law, is something that's perfect and absolutely applicable to society. And therefore, that being the case, if anyone would decide not to use halacha and try to determine their case based on something else, that's a very strong and very negative statement the person is making. My time is running out. I'll just make one or two short points. One is, oftentimes people will say, we had a classic case where a child was injured. And it was the type of suit which you got, if you got it in front of a jury in the Bronx, you would be very wealthy. We have every reason to believe. And it was fascinating on many levels, this case. But part of the reason was the parents were arguing that we have to do what's best for our child. If we go to secular court, we'll get more money. The answer to that is, if you had an opportunity to steal money on behalf of your child, would you think that you would be obligated to do it? Even if a person could make more money in court, which may be the case in certain cases, that's not your money. That's the equivalent of sticking your hand in the person's pocket and taking it out. Just because the courts and the law will give me the money, if halachically it's not yours, it's not yours. What if I am entitled to ribbis? You're not allowed to take ribbis. The Beis Din will give it to you. The court will give it to you. You're right. And you know what? That's not good. You're not entitled to that money. That's not your money. Beyond the ribbis problems, that's also stealing. So the argument that I might hear from time to time that, you know, after all, I'm going to do better there, it could be your right. But again, there's other ways to steal money as well, which you wouldn't do. Don't do it this way either. That's point number one. Point number two is, if you look at the course materials, which I haven't touched at all, because they are self-explanatory and I'll encourage people to read it, there are situations out there where there's a question about whether going to a Beis Din is appropriate. For example, just to give a brief rundown, if your opposition will not go with you, so then you apply to the Beis Din. When the person shows that they're not coming, then you get what's called a heter or kos. At that point, you're allowed to go to the civil courts to collect. Is there ever an assumption that the other party is not going to go? For example, what if the other party is not Jewish? So I think we generally assume that the other party is not Jewish. You can safely assume that, but still it's probably best to get your heterarchos. What if the other party is not Jewish but wants to go to Beis Din? As we've had some real good cases on recently. In that situation, I believe that the majority opinion, even though there are strong opinions both ways, is that you do go to Beis Din with the non-Jew. Oftentimes there are situations where it's hard to figure out who the parties are. If a person's involved in a car accident, for example, even if two Jews are involved, oftentimes the true party is the insurance company, who likely isn't Jewish. We generally assume that is true, unless the insurance company wants to go to Beis Din, which you might think it's crazy, but it's really not, because we've had such cases already happen now. The last point is the only other issue which should be noted, but again, the article should be read. It's a well-written article by someone other than me, which is the issue of child custody. In general, when a person goes to Beis Din, they can rest assured that the decision that was made in Beis Din will be upheld by the civil courts. In situations of child custody and one or two other minor exceptions, the court maintains the right to oversee every part of the decision. Meaning, unlike a typical civil case where the only way you can get it overturned is to show that there's been some sort of fraud or the Beis Din overstepping its bounds, that is not true in child custody. They can redo the case on their own. They generally don't. However, there is a discussion in a case like that where the decision of the Beis Din will not truly be final, whether or not there is an obligation to go to the Beis Din. It could be obligation or not, it still might be the best idea for you and your children. And with that, I will leave off and turn over the podium to the next speaker. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Rabbi Rapp. I'll just add, in terms of child custody, Rabbi Rapp didn't mention that there is a case in your materials, the Fawzi case. Even though the rule generally is, in many states, that courts retain the right to review a Beis Din or an arbitration panel's determination on custody issues, in New Jersey, that's not necessarily the case. And under the Fawzi case, which was decided a few years ago, I think in 2009 or 2010, the courts will generally defer to the determination of an arbitration panel of a Beis Din, even on child custody matters, unless the decision of the Beis Din is outrageous and is really, you know, endangers the safety of the child, or unless the Beis Din didn't follow basic procedures that the court outlines in its decision. And so the Beis Din of America, without question, in a case involving child custody, will follow those basic safeguards outlined in Fawzi. But it's an interesting development in the law in the past few years that affects some of what we do.